Hello and welcome to Tickets, a podcast series exploring the future of live experiences. Each episode, we take you behind the scenes with the visionaries, producers and operators delivering some of the most vital and innovative experiences around. From Broadway theatre to international boxing, virtual reality to retail. Tickets aims to join the dots between disciplines, share knowledge and new ideas, and better understand what goes into bringing these experiences to life. My name's Howard Gray. I'm the founder of H Bureau, a specialist consultancy practice helping media, entertainment and experience companies grow. Sustainability is a topic that's got a lot of attention over the past few years. We know it's important to create sustainable experiences, but what's the next step we can take? How can we make the built environment better for our health? And how does wellness really inform the quality of experiences we have? New York-based research firm Delos have been exploring this theme for nearly a decade, working across sectors including air travel, sports and hospitality to help companies create multi-use spaces that have a genuinely positive effect on our well-being. On the guest list today is Ross Guttler, VP of Business Development at Delos. Over the course of this wide-ranging conversation, we got into the future of retail and mixed-use space, why IT departments will be running buildings, the science behind productivity, and explorations into the London rave scene at the turn of the millennium. Enjoy. Ross, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
First off, let's just talk a little bit about Delos. Could you maybe just briefly introduce the company and your role here?
Yeah, sure. So we started about really 7, 8, 9 years ago. And I say we existed for a while in stealth R&D mode, like a lot of companies, I think, pushing the envelope. And what we did is we looked at the real estate industry and saw how successful sustainability was blending in with real estate to really drive the market and change the way people develop real estate. And we looked at it and we thought, well, okay, it's great. We're focusing on the environment. What are we doing about the people inside? And so we spent a long time actually just doing research, trying to figure out how much of an impact the buildings had on our health. And we got a lot of doctors together and architects and engineers and scientists and developers, and we got them all in a room, figuratively and even literally, and said, all right, if we put everybody's brain power here together, can we make a difference in real estate for the occupants? And the answer was a resounding yes. And so that's what we do. We take buildings, we take spaces, and we make them healthy for people. And we do that through focusing on air, water, sound, temperature, light, nutrition, fitness, every single thing you can imagine that goes on in a building that impacts our health. We optimize it to make us healthier. I started when we were less than 10 people. And at that time, we had no departments, so I did a lot of research. I remember, I think one of our principals said to me, Russ, we need to figure out, can we do something on planes? And so I spent a week just researching wellness on planes. So my role has evolved. I have had a lot of responsibility in our corporate development and venture capital department. And so I've been an advisor to some of the companies that we invest in. And then now I manage some of our large strategic partnerships and alliances.
So the company's kind of in a really interesting space, kind of a somewhat nascent space, but also connected to real estate. So what area did you come from to get into this? What was your story and your history to get from starting your career to being here?
Well, probably my start really had nothing to do with this. And I think this was a funny story you and I talked about before. I wanted to be an investment banker when I was in college because it was the late 90s and that's what everybody wanted to do where I went to school. And I was in an interview and the guy was asking me about lifestyle and he said, you know, Ross, I'm sure you understand our lifestyle. And I'm thinking in my head, yeah, it's 110 hours a week. I'm asleep under my desk 2 or 3 days a week and not go home and change clothes. And yeah, I get it. And I walked out of the interview and I thought, man, what the hell am I doing? You know, this is not what I want to do with my life. Or at least not in my early 20s. And I called him up. I said, you know, take me out of the running for the job. I'm not interested, but I appreciate it. And I called up all my other interviews and I canceled them. And I moved out to Aspen and I've been out there one time, had no job, had no place to stay, and found a job on my first day sitting at the bar drinking a beer. Guy offered me a job from behind the bar. Bartended and waited tables for about 3 years. And that had nothing to do with what I'm doing today. But I think it's interesting because if you're passionate about something, obviously everybody will tell you to pursue it. In retrospect, I was like, yeah, I was passionate about skiing. That's not necessarily a profession or anything, but that's the way it went. And then my friend was in Phoenix doing Teach for America, and he wanted to start a company flipping houses. So that was actually my approach into real estate. He called me up and he said, you know, I could use some help. And I said, okay, I'm getting a little restless up here, waiting tables and bartending. And so I moved down to Phoenix and we started a company flipping houses. And we were really, really shitty business partners. We were best friends and we were roommates and we had the same skill set. So I think we broke every rule about how not to identify a good business partner. We're lucky we're still friends today. Joe Diaz, hello. He runs a very successful, actually, media company called Afar Media, which is awesome. You guys should check it out. But Joe and I were terrible, terrible business partners. Broke that up. I got into development and did office and industrial development with a group called ViaWest in Phoenix. And now they're one of the top groups in Phoenix. I was their first employee. And then I got into advisory work and brokerage, and I did office and industrial brokerage. And I saw the market turning and developed relationships with a few banks really early on and looked at what was going on in residential and realized, okay, people are losing their houses. It's only a matter of time before people start losing their offices as well. And in Phoenix, a lot of people owned office buildings, a lot of individual users, doctors, architects, lawyers, accountants, things like that. So I started working with a lot of banks and helping them advise them on their distressed portfolios. And eventually, a lady named Beth Jo Zeitzer came to me and said, Ross, you seem to have more of these listings and relationships than anybody in Phoenix. I have a company doing this on the residential side. Why don't we join forces? And so we did, and I started the commercial division there, and it was awesome. Beth Jo was one of the best bosses and partners anybody could ask for. She taught me a lot and we're still friends. And I think the real estate game in a traditional sense just got a little stale for me, and it wasn't as intellectually stimulating or gratifying or satisfying as I wanted it to be. And I started reading a lot of behavioral science books and behavioral economics books. Particularly Dan Ariely was one of the people I really just loved the way he wrote and told a story. And so I thought, all right, I want to go back to school and focus on behavioral science, but in a business sense. I'd always felt like I gravitated toward corporate and business strategy. I just didn't have a formal education in it. So I applied to go to business school at Fuqua, which is Duke's business school, where Dan Ariely was. And about 2 months before school, I'd come back from like a 3 or 4 month trip in Central America, and I got back and I had 2 months, and I called up one of the principals at Delos because I had a friend that was an investor. And I said, Renato, I love what you guys do. I've been following you for a few years because my buddy's an investor, and I'm going to go to business school in 2 months. Let me come work for you and don't pay me a penny. And he was like, okay, I'm not going to say no to that. You want to come up here and work for us for 2 months and we're not going to pay you? And I said, yes. He said, okay.
And you weren't in New York at the time, right?
I was not. No. I was coming from Phoenix. So I came up here for 2 months and just did whatever the hell they wanted me to do. And I got ridiculously enthusiastic about it. And I thought, this is the future of real estate. You know, my dad was a doctor. So when I went over it with him, like what this company was doing and how it was really taking real estate that before had frankly just been poisoning us while we're inside the whole time, and taking it and using it as a delivery vehicle to actually make us healthier. And I remember having dinner with my dad, and he said, Ross, you know, if I've done a good job in my career, I'll have maybe impacted the health of a few thousand people. He said, you guys could impact billions of people. And he said, and you'll make my job a little less necessary. And he said, I'm going to retire soon anyway, so no sweat off my back. And so I think getting the buy-in of, it's not just that he's my dad and I respect his opinion, but someone from the medical community saying, yeah, you know, preventative care, taking the building and making it so people don't get sick and don't have to come to me. That's the big thing to do. So I came to Delos, went back, I worked there for 2 months, went back to business school, did all through business school, actually, took classes that would make me better when I was here. Came back up here, worked over the summer, did a little bit with our venture capital group and our corporate development group, advised some of the portfolio companies that we have, went back to business school, kept working the whole time. So the whole time I was in business school, I kept flying back up here once a month and working and missing class, frankly. And then when I graduated, I came up here right away, and sort of the rest has been history.
So I'm really interested to get into a little bit more about what the company do and maybe how the vision has evolved. Because you said Delos has been around maybe 8-9 years, something like that. And you've been, I guess you've been part of that for kind of most of that journey. What's the kind of main vision of the business, and how has that kind of evolved as maybe technology's evolved and the needs of customers have evolved over that period?
Well, it's interesting you say the needs of customers. That is certainly important, because I feel like we're creating a market segment. And so sometimes it's the difficulty in what we do is you have to even educate people that they have a need. You know, I think a lot of people are fortunate. Most businesses are fortunate enough. You go in and you convince somebody, okay, you have a problem and you already know you have a problem. I'm going to convince you I have the best solution. What we do, the complex thing about what we do is I have to convince you even have a problem. You didn't even realize the building was making you sick, and you didn't realize the building could make you better.
So we're sitting in the Delos office in New York. It's a really, really lovely day. Apparently it's going to snow tomorrow, and you're both getting nervous about that. But it's a lovely day today, and the space is fantastic. We're right next to the Hudson River, and you guys really do practice what you preach. I know beforehand you showed me around a little bit. Can you kind of just talk me through how the office is set up so that the building is beneficial for the people that work within it? Some of the features of this space, let alone some of you, we'll get into your clients' ones later, but this space particularly, what's been done to make it as healthy as possible?
Yeah. Well, it's a great question, and I could take many days and explain to you everything that has gone on that you can see that's in front of you, but everything that's also behind the walls. I used to like to tell people that we've got the healthiest office in the world, but our attorneys let me know that that is not something I should be saying.
So you, just to be clear, you haven't said that.
So I haven't. I have not said we have the healthiest office in the world. What I will say is I'm not aware of any other office anywhere in the world that went through the intentional and thoughtful effort to run every design and construction and policy and protocol decision through this lens of, is this optimal for our health? Every single decision we looked at was, is this optimal for our health? And if it wasn't, we went another direction. And that's a pretty powerful statement, that when you walk in here, you know every single thing here was optimized for our health. So you think about how many other aspects of your life do you go in where every element of whatever experience, I mean, let's make this about an experience. Think of how many experiences you get that have that level of consistency. It's really hard to do. I mean, that's what you interview people about, but I'm sure people tell you it is not easy. So that's something we did here, and we're looking to share that knowledge with the entire industry and the rest of the world. So what's going on in this space? You know, we've got lights here that mimic the outdoor sun, that help our body maintain natural circadian rhythms so that we wake up at the right time. And our body releases cortisol, suppresses melatonin, you get active. You know, toward the end of the day, the lights change color temperature and wavelength so that your body releases melatonin and suppresses cortisol, gets you ready for sleep. That's and we've got probably 10 other features here that are related to light. And then we've got, I would guess, 15 to 20 aspects related to air quality. Anything from a ridiculous amount of filtration system to things like we've got active green walls. We found a company called Nava out of Finland that made the coolest but also the smartest green walls we've ever come across. We spent 2 or 3 years actually scouring the market for them. And what they do is, instead of cleaning air through the leaves, they realized you can clean air better through the roots.
So just to clarify for someone maybe who isn't familiar with exactly what a green wall is, it's effectively a wall made up almost 100% of plants.
A wall made of plants. And what this system does is it has a carbon media mixed in with the roots, and it has sensors in the system that detect when the air quality reaches a certain unhealthy level, and has a fan system and starts pulling air through the roots in the carbon media, cleaning the air. And to give you a number, because I think the numbers are really powerful, each plant cleans 69 to 249 times more than a natural outdoor plant because of the whole system. And so when you look at how many plants are in a natural wall, and I read this number the other day, having one wall is equivalent to having 4,000 outdoor plants in your room.
Wow. And how many you have?
Think about what that would look like if you had 4,000 outdoor plants.
Well, it would barely, yeah, wouldn't
you'd
fit.
You'd be in a jungle. Yeah. Right.
And you guys have a number of
these. We have 21 walls. Of them.
You have 21 of these in this building
in
that we're 19, in.
19,000 feet of office space.
Which in this building that we're in right now.
Yes.
So these kind of initiatives that you've got, you're practicing what you preach, these are the kind of things that you're starting to install into client spaces.
Exactly.
And you're working with primarily developers or architects or a mixture?
I would say half our clients are Fortune 500 corporate clients. On the user side, the ones that occupy, and then half of them are developers. And then we also do work with some service providers like architects and engineers.
So I know you mentioned before we started recording that there's a number of business units within Delos. Can you maybe just briefly explain, as there's some research side, there's some more kind of practical implementation parts of the business. Can you maybe just briefly take us through those parts?
I mean, at the heart, we're a research company. You know, I mean, we commercialize that research, but we are where we are because we've spent a lot of money getting the best researchers together under one roof. So we've got an internal group called Delos Labs, and that's probably 20 plus PhDs and masters in different types of science and health fields. And they really drive everything we do. I mean, every single thing we look at, whether it's a product or a technology or a service, gets run through our labs group. And they're doing a lot of primary and secondary research. And you know, years ago, we work and collaborate a lot with the Mayo Clinic and the Cleveland Clinic. And Mayo said, you know, this is the future of real estate. We realize that. And we think it's also the future of health. We want to do more than just collaborate with you on research. So we decided to go 50-50, and we built a lab on Mayo's Rochester, Minnesota campus. And that lab is called the Well Living Lab. And it tests everything going on in the built environment and the impact on our health. So, for example, if I've got poor air quality, but you've got a seat that's got poor ergonomics and there's noise in the background and you're 3 degrees warmer than you would like to be comfortable, but I have great light and you have poor light, how do we mix all that together and find out who's more or less productive, who's more or less stressed, who sleeps better? And so that's what the lab is testing. And they take that research and they give it to insurance companies and feed it to policymakers. And, you know, our goal is that we're going to drive some policy change.
One of the areas that I thought was really interesting was the Well AP that you guys have set up. So correct me if I'm wrong, but that's almost like an accreditation program for professionals who want to become experts in wellness in the workplace. Can you maybe explain a little bit more about how that came to be and how that works?
Yeah. Well, you use both the words. Well, AP is an accredited professional.
Oh, good. I got it right.
Yeah, you got it right, man. So just the same way there's a lead AP, which I think there's like hundreds of thousands of lead APs across the world, we created a Well AP.
Lead being for building specifically.
Lead being for, I think it's leadership in energy and environmental design, something like that. I should probably know better, but I'm not. I don't come from a sustainability background. But there are lead APs, and those are people that are in the service industry that want to be able to work on lead projects, lead being a certification that's focused on environmental sustainability. We created a certification called the Well Building Standard that's sort of analogous to lead, but focuses on sustainability for people instead of buildings. And in the same way, you can be a certified practitioner for that, an accredited practitioner. And that's a Well AP. And there's thousands of them now across in just 2 years. There are thousands of them already.
And their role is almost thinking about it like a coach?
Yeah, exactly.
They are working with organizations.
You shepherd projects through the process. You're seen as an expert. It's definitely something you put on your business card, stuff like that.
You mentioned that you don't come from a sustainability background, but quite a few people here do. I think a lot of people conflate wellness and sustainability. It's quite easy to get the terms confused.
Yeah.
From Delos' perspective, where do you guys sit on that spectrum, and where are the differences between the two disciplines, I suppose?
Some people label what we do wellness, I would say, in the built environment as sustainability 2.0. That sustainability 1.0 was focusing on how the building impacts the environment. 2.0 is how it impacts the people. I think that is a correct way to look at it. I say personally, I look at it a little bit differently, and I think of what does the word sustainability really mean? It's just to sustain. I don't necessarily think of it as improving. So, I mean, to give you an example, if you had a building that was a negative 10 and you made it so that it was net zero and contributed, somehow you figured out how the entire supply chain and carbon footprint and everything about that building, it did nothing negative to the environment. Now you've got it to be a zero. To me, that's sustainable. The building hasn't hurt anybody. But now if you put a bunch of solar panels on that building and it generates electricity and gives back, well, now the building's like a positive 2 or 3. I don't know if I'd call that sustainable. I'd say that's better than sustainable. And so I look at what we do and I would say, all right, if your building was a negative 10 and we get it to a zero, yeah, then it's sustainable. But what we're doing is, you know, I mean, when I look at what working at Delos and working in this space has done for me, it's not like it just corrected some of my maladies where, let's say, my diet wasn't optimal and now it is. Okay, well, that's just getting me back to where I should be. But the fact that I'm doing things like meditating every day and I would say focusing more on being positive and giving back, those are things that I don't think are at a zero. Those are a positive. So I would say this space and working at this company has had a tremendously positive impact on my life and has taken me past just zero. Now I'm a positive. And I'm not trying to say I was like a negative person before, but to me, that surpasses sustainability. So I don't know if that's like too theoretical about, you know, or too conceptual about the term sustainability, but I think we're going to get past that.
So is it fair to say that like sustainability is almost like the baseline and then wellness is what takes it above? Yeah.
Yeah. Or I think there can be sustainable wellness where you're getting a building that doesn't harm you.
Yes.
Because a lot of
the research you guys have done is that there's a lot of buildings that do harm us, even though it doesn't appear that they do.
Almost everyone out there is.
Can you give us an example maybe from some of the research you guys have done, or maybe just an anecdotal example of a building that we wouldn't think about to be harmful?
Yeah.
Is it if it's a mall or something like that?
I think light is probably the concept I am most fascinated about what we do. I read an awesome study by one of my favorite scientists, this guy, Dr. Hattar from Hopkins. And I remember it was a study he did a few years ago, and it basically said the light you see in the middle of the day, at 2 in the afternoon, affects whether your body digests food at 2:45 or 3:15 in the morning. And that, first of all, when I initially read that study, I remember thinking, shit, I didn't even know that's when my body digested food. So that's news to me.
So yeah, well, like, I just learned that too.
All right. And then that just half hour shift in digestion can lead to an early onset of all types of bad stuff, like multiple types of cancer and other things that are bad for your body, all from a half hour shift in digestion. And I came away from that study and I was like, shit, man, the light we see all day really is a medicine. And it can be a good medicine and it can do the right things for you, which the sun does. The sun is definitely the best medicine in terms of light that there is. Or it can poison you and it can hinder your performance and it can increase your stress and put you in a bad mood and cause you sleep problems. And that's what most people are experiencing every single day.
Whether you're at work or I suppose in leisure time as well, if you're going to a museum or to a shopping mall or whatever it is, or
totally.
To a concert.
Whenever I'm in a restaurant, whenever I have this conversation with people, like you're in a restaurant and you look up at the lights and they're really dim. And I say, okay, aren't you comfortable here now? Yeah, we are. Cause it's 8 o'clock at night. Great. Guess what? That light bulb's the exact same at 8 in the morning. You think that's what your body wants at 8 in the morning? No, your body actually wants something that's a little brighter that tells you to suppress melatonin, release cortisol, and go through the cycles that your body wants to go through to be active during the day. So, you know, our bodies were intended to be outside. We've only been put inside four walls and a roof for a few thousand years, and we have not fully evolved yet to catch up with that.
So let's dig into that a little bit more. So maybe particularly around hospitality and retail, which are, mm-hmm. in terms of leisure activities, probably two of the most popular things. What do you think the retail experience of the future should look like or maybe could look like?
Yeah. what's going on in retail is fascinating, and I think it's potentially the most excited sector of real estate to think about what the future of it will look like. To me, there's really three big factors that are influencing what retail will look like. One, it's autonomous vehicles. Two, it's AR and VR. And three, it's moving sales to online. So the third part of that, that's understood. Everybody gets what that's doing to retail. You need more reason to bring people into a store, right? If you can buy online and we can sit in our home in our pajamas and buy something, why are we going to go into the store? You go into the store for experience. Now, the first two, I think, are a little more complex. So let's say autonomous vehicles. All right, how's that going to affect retail? Well, if you look at the amount of square footage devoted to parking lots in this country, it's about 152 billion feet.
Sorry, now, can you just repeat that?
It's 152 billion feet.
Right.
Now, I think
just on parking lots
just,
in the U.S.
Just on parking alone. What will surprise you is that if you look at office, apartments, shopping malls, strip centers, storage space, and industrial, and you combine all of those, take a guess how much that is.
I don't want to guess. Those numbers are starting to get scary how huge they are. I'm guessing it's going to be a hell of a lot more, several times more.
It's a third.
It's a third of the parking.
It's 50 or 52 million. I can't remember.
So this is all retail.
Billion, sorry.
Retail, strip malls, industrial space,
all
of that,
everything
all combined.
But single family homes.
Right. So any kind of commercial space.
There's about 50 billion square feet.
A third of the
parking
space.
Across the U.S.
Okay.
There's three times as much parking.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Like, let that sink in. I mean, dude, that's crazy. Okay. Some people say we're going to need 90% less parking spaces.
Because of autonomous vehicles.
Right. Because when you can sit in a city like we are right now in New York, and the autonomous vehicles can just basically circle the city and go through the city in some interconnected web, you don't need parking inside the city. They all park in places outside the city. And you don't need as much parking because not everybody needs cars. So if you think about, and the range, people project anywhere from 50 to 90% reduction in parking needs.
Okay, so you're talking 70 billion square feet, potentially a lot more.
Loads of square footage comes back to the market. Okay? All right, so let's still put ourselves in the position of a retailer. All right, so there's going to be a lot more space. So it's not going to be maybe as much of a premium on what you're doing. Who knows what's going to happen with all that other space? Okay. But where the autonomous vehicles go, to me, is an important thing here. And that's how you get to the second piece of this, which is the AR and VR. I remember hearing a few years ago, you don't need to go to a store anymore. An autonomous vehicle will come to your apartment and you can go outside and look at the clothes in the car or whatever it is. The vehicle comes and delivers the store to you. All right. Okay, that's made possible with autonomous vehicles, still traditional clothing. But then the AR and VR folks came, particularly the AR folks came along and said, why do we even need to go down to the car? How about the clothing just comes into your apartment? You use augmented reality and you can see what the clothing looks like on your body. You don't even need the car. So to me, I'm like, okay, well now how are you going to get somebody to go in a store? And I think this is something you and I are both passionate about. You know, we both love music, and I think it's really funny that back in the late 90s and early 2000s, you and I were in the same clubs in London.
Listening
to the same DJs that you represented and worked with, which is just fucking amazing, man. It's such a hilarious story. But how do you get people attracted into space? So you think about, okay, sales are moving online. Fine. Okay, people can try on clothing in their home. Okay, there's also a bunch of space coming back. You mix all that together. What does that do to retail? How do you get people in there? It's your word, man. It's experience. And I think you create that experience with things like art and music and other aspects of culture. To me, they define what's cool. I think you get people into a store by making it cool.
And for people to care about that in the future, there's the cultural part, but presumably there's also the the wellness and the quality and the sustainability of the experience as well. It's all very well having a band playing in a retail store, totally. But without the other aspects.
I should have made that point. I'm glad you made that point.
I'm good.
That's my job. But I should have said that. Yeah, I think part of the cool is people won't have spaces that don't focus on your health. It'll just be standard.
So in the future, you see, if you think about the three things you talked about, the future of retail will be that having a space that is good for you will be de facto. That will just be like yes. It won't even become a thing in 5, 10, 15 years.
Right. And then you combine that with whatever elements of the word cool you want to bring in. I think that's how you get people in there. I mean, I think look at what Adidas and Nike are doing now with all the different artists they collaborate with. And yeah. I mean, artists as in true art, you know, artists and then also musicians. It's unbelievable. I see retail needing to go the same way.
So the retailers are going to have to become more focused on experience. I definitely agree with that. What do you think the hospitality sector will move the same way, or is it less susceptible to all this disruption from autonomous vehicles and VR and parking lot issues and all these kind of things?
I think it is moving in the same way. Yeah, I think the prevailing thought in the real estate community right now is you're seeing a merging of all sectors of real estate. Hospitality, office, and residential are all starting to look similar. You want a high-end Class A office building out, you've got to add hospitality features. You've got to add residential type of features. You know, you want a nice apartment building now, you know, people are adding co-working spaces and stuff like that. So it's all starting to look the same.
So you spend quite a bit of your time at future of real estate conferences and trying to figure out what's going on, infer what's going on, and speaking at them and so on. The key talking points that everything's merging. What are people most excited about? What are they most worried about?
Yeah, I say everything's merging, definitely. So I think that is one of the top two or three points. People don't know what autonomous vehicles are going to do. Some people think it'll push everybody out to suburbia and exurbia because a lot of people think once you're used to a 45-minute commute, you're okay with that. You don't really desire a 15-minute one that much. If I can put you in an autonomous vehicle and you can sit in the back and read a paper and drink your coffee, but now you can live twice as far away from the city and have a bigger yard, people think, okay, you're good with that. And so a lot of people feel exurbia will become a more popular option. And by exurbia, I mean past suburbia. Other people look at it and say, no, urbanization has been the trend for 10, 15 years. Everybody wants to live in the city. I don't know which of those is going to win. I think what's interesting to think, going back to an earlier point, is if we get all that space from parking lots back and we turn some of it into parks, shouldn't that make people want to come back to the city? You know, if people like you and I are moving out to exurbia so we can have a big yard and raise kids and have however many dogs we want. I mean, if there's a lot more parks near our apartments in the city, isn't that going to make city life a little more appetizing? So we'll see. I don't know. So I would say that's one thing everybody thinks about. I think the other is as everything gets put on a sensor, the sensorification of the entire building, who really ends up controlling the building? The guys that have been doing what we call OT, which is operational technology, facilities folks, or the IT department. And that is a real like loggerhead situation right now, because the IT department is, I'm going to stereotype here, 25-year-old kids, you know, in t-shirts and jeans. And the OT department is, you know, men and women that have been there, been running that same building for 30 years. And those two don't really talk to each other. And now they have to talk to each other.
Has IoT made that
totally
change happen?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's the fault. Yeah. That's the thing, that the wedge that's sat in between them, and now they've had to talk.
These are not two groups that want to hang out.
Yeah.
They don't want to get beers together. And this is forcing them to. And so what people wonder now is, who's really going to end up controlling the building? And I think most people think it's going to be IT.
So in the future, because IT will control the IoT, which runs the building.
They'll control everything. Everything is going to be so connected that if the man or woman that runs your IT department doesn't have the grand vision for the way the whole space operates, you're not going to be running it at full capacity.
But presumably the vision that Delos set out is that those, if the IT people do end up running the building, they need to have the tools and abilities and I guess interest in sustainability and wellness to go with that, because you can't just run it purely with technology.
Or is the technology going to be sophisticated? I think the technology needs a purpose, you know, and we give that technology a purpose. So I think the beauty about what we do is we bridge the gap between OT and IT. You know, we say to the facilities teams, hey, look, we can help optimize everything you're doing with your mechanical systems and your light and your water, everything you guys are doing. We can help you optimize that for occupant health. And we go to the IT folks and say, I know you want to put sensors everywhere, but do you actually know what you should be measuring? Do you know where to put the sensors and how to measure it? Do you know how to make sure you're getting clean data versus dirty data? Once you get clean data, do you even know what strategy you should have to make use of that data? And then once you have a strategy in place, do you even know how to implement that strategy in relation to data and optimizing it for the people inside?
So for a developer, is the challenge now knowing where to invest? So do you invest into your ops team? Do you invest in your IT team? Do you invest into a company like you guys? Is that the kind of conundrum?
Everybody should invest in us. That is,
of course, naturally.
Yeah. Hire us, for sure.
Is this something that developers are wrestling with right now?
It is.
Yeah. So which way is it going to go?
It is, and I think, going back to the sustainability question, guys like Rick Fedrizzi and Jason McLennan, who were early advisors to Delos, did such an amazing job in this industry making sustainability be mandatory. And it got to a point where you had a lot of what we call greenwashing. People would call what they did sustainable, and it really wasn't sustainable. We're seeing that with what we do. We call it well washing. You know, I mean, like, I think when I walk by the Rite Aid on my way into work, wellness is the second biggest word on the side of the building. It says Rite Aid, and then it says wellness. Dude, they're the same pharmacy they were 10 years ago that they were 30 years ago. They're not a wellness center. They just like the word wellness because it's a good branding word. And so we see well washing being a thing. And so it makes it difficult for people to decide, where do you invest? Do you check a box and just do something that's super, super basic and say, hey, we did this. We took care of the people inside the space. Or do you go more comprehensive and more focused and really dig in deep? And, you know, obviously I opt for the latter because I've seen the studies and I know how big of a difference it makes. Also, I live it. Like, I feel it. I'm here every day. It's really easy to talk about it and to evangelize for it when you live in the space and you see how big of a difference it's made on your life.
So something you said, the Rite Aid thing's interesting, actually, because I think the well washing thing is I really feel it too. And I think a lot of people do. I think a lot of people maybe around our kind of age, maybe younger too, are thinking about sustainability or wellness and how can I have more of that in my life? A lot of the listeners of this podcast are running in their own businesses, so maybe independent freelancers or entrepreneurs. What advice do you have for someone who's delivering an experience to an audience or employees or customers, whether it's a festival or a pop-up store or in the hospitality sector? What could they look at straight away to figure out if they're on the right track and how they can improve in terms of this area?
I think it's authenticity in creating the experience. It seems to me folks younger than you and I'll put you and I in that group.
We're very young, of course.
They can see through the bullshit. They see through this washing. When you create, whether it's well washing, green washing, whatever it is, when you create an experience and you only do some of the high level stuff and you leave out the details, I think people see right through it and you end up with a negative reaction. And with social media, it's so easy. Only a few people need to see the bullshit and have a negative reaction. You don't need 90% of the consumers of your experience to understand you were a little inauthentic and you cut corners. Three people need to see it. You know what? Actually, one person with the right audience, if they have a lot of followers, if they see that you're not really delivering the experience that you're trying to brand and market, they could totally wreck you. They could totally bring you down.
I think you're right. I've seen it because I had a conversation just yesterday afternoon with someone and he was talking about his former employer, an experience company, where there was some problems on social media with customers kind of to this point.
Yeah.
And his bosses said, ignore it. Until it gets over X number, we ignore it. And that was a really bad move. And it blew up in their face really badly. So I completely agree. in terms of the tactics someone could utilize to improve the experience they're delivering, how can they do that if they don't have the budget to spend a lot of money on biophilia or incredible lighting systems, that kind of thing? What would your advice be just to get started and start making a difference?
I'd say think about the effect and the result that you're really going for and then optimize around that. So, right, everybody doesn't have the deepest pockets to do everything, and everybody's not going to hire us or, you know, other folks out there doing similar things to us. I would say figure out what's most important to you and do everything authentically for that result. You don't have to cover all results. You know, I'm sure there's some element of the experience you're wanting to deliver that really is like the crux of it. That's the core of it. So figure out that and devote all your energy toward that.
Could you maybe share what your biggest learning has been over the last 12 months or so, either personally or professionally or within your industry?
I would say I'm going to tie it back to another question you asked, which is what's a hot topic at the future of real estate? Delivering culture. Every company, every large corporation now is hyper-focused on how do we authentically deliver the culture that we are proclaiming to the industry. And that's because companies like Google have done such a great job creating an office that everybody wants to work in. And it's also a good culture. I'm not going to name other companies, but there are other Fortune 100 companies that are almost as big as Google, and they're known as not having a good culture. And people go work there just because they want it on their resume. That's not the case with Google. People don't want to leave. And I think that's amazing. So what I've learned is we need to focus what we do, not just about improving health, but it's also about delivering a culture of health, a culture of wellness, because that's what millennials want.
Do you think companies understand what they want this culture to be, or is it the execution and implementation they struggle with, or is it also the whole concept and the strategy behind it as well?
I don't think they totally get it. I think you've got a lot of people in their 50s and 60s sitting in rooms making decisions, saying, what do the kids want in the office? They want a ping pong table. Okay, fine. That's not that expensive. I think that's what goes on.
Yeah, I think the beer tap and the ping pong table is kind of becoming somewhat passe now, right?
Yeah. People think those are easy answers, but that's not what everybody wants. Going back to what we were saying earlier, you got to do it authentically. People can tell when you're bullshitting.
Yeah.
Like, Google's authentic about it.
I must admit, we had a chat beforehand, so I think I might know what the answer is going to be. It made me smile. We alluded to it earlier. Your most memorable live experience, either through Delos or personally in your life?
We did have a little chat about this, and it's funny because I can go back and reference for your veteran listeners.
veteran.
Debs Armstrong mentioned squat parties in London. I don't remember what year she said.
Debs was a guest on our second episode. She was our guest.
Which I loved that interview, by the way. And she does awesome stuff with Glastonbury, and I'm sure a lot of other places. I remember I was with a buddy, and we went to a squat party for New Year's, maybe 99 or 2000 in North London. And it was some, I don't know, 6-story building. And on every floor, there were like 3 different scenarios and experiences you could have on every single floor. There's a different DJ on every floor. There were places you could create art. There were places you could take a nap. There were like chill out here, all different dance party areas, everything. And we were blown away.
This was a not completely legit legal party, I'm assuming.
Yeah, so I think Debs, squat parties are, it's a building that, what do they call it? It's an unoccupied building. I don't know who owns it. I mean,
there'll be a developer somewhere.
It's a squatter building that no one's occupying, and kids take it over and throw a party, or adults. I don't know how old people were, but it was amazing. And we both were really, really blown away by just the whole experience of it. I would say that, and then funny enough, another one in London. Maybe that's because grew up in a little small furniture town in North Carolina, so being in a big city like London, I was pretty wowed by what went on. And I loved live music, as we talked about. I remember going to a party with a bunch of my friends in a parking garage somewhere like sort of south central London. And it was unbelievable. You know, it's one of those parties you get to at like 11 or 12 at night and you stay till 9 in the morning. And I remember there were all these different chill out rooms and probably four different DJs. And, you know, it was a parking garage during the week. So, you know, you walked out and you realized all your shoes were totally black. The bottoms of your pants were black. And you're like, oh, shit, man, I've definitely been hanging out in like soot or ash.
Motor oil and all sorts of other stuff.
Crazy. But I mean, to this day, I still vividly remember aspects of that party. And it was one of the best parties I've ever been to.
So as a tip for anyone looking to reestablish their parking lot, part of the 150 billion square feet.
There you go.
Maybe they can
throw parties.
Throw parties.
Well, I think it's something you and I are both interested in. It, both the experiences I'm talking about, it's art and music. You know, going back to retail, how are people going to create experience? I think if art, music, and really health are not the three core components, I think you're going in the wrong direction.
Join us next time for another edition of Tickets. You can subscribe via Apple Podcasts and Stitcher, or listen back through SoundCloud and Acast. Tickets is an HBRO production. Find out more at hbro.com.